Hi.
I'm Tracy.
I'm April.
And this is Killer Spirits.
Welcome to episode 14.
Episode 14.
I'm so happy that we're here.
Me too.
It feels like I haven't done this in 100 years, and here we are.
Here we are.
Another settling week. In.
Another week. Happy fucking New Year.
Happy fucking New Year. How's your New Year's?
I don't know. I've decided that January has been historically a depressing month for me, and okay. I feel like that's why we have always planned a fun trip in January.
Oh.
There's always been something fun going on for me in January. Mm-hmm. And so we would go to, you know, Vegas. We would go, I don't know. There's always be somewhere that we would go. Normally we go to Vegas. Something to look forward to after I put the Christmas stuff away and I feel like super depressed. This year I have nothing. I have nothing to look forward to, April. Nothing.
You have this.
I have this. Yes, that's true. But the thought of having nothing to look forward to is like really depressing. But anyway.
Anything planned for summer?
No.
Oh. Well,
I know. It's kind of sad. But I've actually been listening to some really good podcasts. I was going to tell people about it.
Oh, okay.
So I was completely entrenched in this podcast. And this might be old news to people because I feel like I'm always behind the curve just a little.
Whatever.
But if you haven't listened to The Root of Evil, it is two sisters talking about their family. And their all these weird intricacies in their family and how their grandfather is possibly the killer of the Black Dahlia. It is such a fucking good podcast. Like, I could not stop listening. I think there's 8 episodes. I think Jason was talking to me multiple times and I'm like, I'm not listening to you. I'm literally entrenched in this.
I cannot engage right now.
I cannot engage. It's so good. But they have a bunch of family members on there and it's a lot. It talks a lot about kind of their life, their mother's life, and also just a lot of healing. I think they did a lot of healing doing this podcast. Anyway, it's a freaking amazing. Mm. And then the other one I listened to is called Bear Brook, which is an old cold case from the 80s. And it was bodies found in, like, you know, those big containers.
Oh, like oil drums?
Kind of, yeah, like oil drums. And kind of how the case has gone on for the past, I think it was just solved recently.
That's cool.
So, and kind of how all these things weave together. And plus, the guy's voice is really sexy, and I really like listening to him.
He always like that.
I don't know why, but... Anyway, those are my two that I want to shout out that have gotten me through the New Year's weekend.
And third shout out, Imbibe the Vibe.
Yeah, I love those
Friends
guys.
Friends of the podcast, Imbibe the Vibe.
They kind of have sexy voices too.
They're
Hi,
cuties.
Hi, guys.
Hi. I put their trailer at the end of last episode. I'll put another one at the end of this episode. But they do like how we do with Cocktail, but they do music. So they're like music nerds. I think they're a band. We're in a band
they're
together.
Amazing. Yeah. And they talk about like kind of obscure music, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And they play it in the background the whole time while they're like talking about it.
It's actually really relaxing.
Yeah.
I've had it on in the background. Like you could just be reading or you could be just like going to sleep. Mm-hmm. But I like their voices a
and
lot.
I think they're hilarious because they also get fucking hammered on their show.
We've gotten fucking hammered a few times.
I've watched like the video... I guess on YouTube or whatever, the video versions of it. And they're like pouring tall drinks like several of them throughout the show. So by the end of the show, they're pretty sloshed. I think it's funny.
So like when COVID's over, guys, can we please get together and drink? Because it sounds amazing.
I think they're in New York.
I'm down with New York.
We could go.
I love New York.
Yeah.
I have friends there. Let's go. I'm going to imbibe some vibes.
So thanks for being friends of the podcast.
Yeah.
Guys.
Thank you so much. We love you guys. So what about you?
Oh, for New Year's?
Yeah.
Well, I drank 2 bottles of Prosecco.
Same.
either burnt or undercooked steak on the...
You don't know?
I don't know.
Do you remember eating it?
Yes. Oh. I undercooked one. Well, that's the problem, is that you just put them on all at the same time, and then, I don't know, I tempt some of them, but the T-bone was overcooked, and the filet was not cooked enough, so...
Oh, no.
What are you gonna do?
What are you gonna do?
And, our neighborhood... So, this is our first year in this neighborhood. I mean, first 6 months, really, still.
Yeah.
We were not here on 4th of July. Oh. And it was, like... I felt like I was in
the middle of a civil war zone.
I felt like I was literally in a civil war. Like, what the fuck?
Honestly, this is me being real, 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 real.
Real, real.
I fucking hate fireworks.
You hate it so much.
And I'm going to tell you, and this is, it actually is a problem for people who have PTSD. Oh, 100%. And it's really hard on animals.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, guys, if you really love your fucking fireworks, but I hate them so much.
They did not stop.
And it's not, they're not, and I'm sorry. I don't want to be negative Nelly, but I was basically like, why y'all celebrating? Like, it's the same shit that's going to be here tomorrow.
Yeah.
But I don't want to, like, rain on the parade of, like, you know, happy thoughts, because I'm not against that. You know, like, it's a new start, and I'm glad for that. But
they were intense fireworks.
Fireworks too. Are not my favorite.
We could, like, see them.
Oh, geez.
Like, in the sky. Like, they were legit, like, a fireworks show.
Wow. Well, you had a bunch of happy people here, everywhere. I guess. Plus, they're dangerous if you've been drinking. I'm sorry. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I definitely condone drinking. In a neighborhood, obviously.
Not a neighborhood here, but like on the other side of the city, someone lit their house and their car on fire.
I'm not surprised.
And almost lit their neighbor's house on fire.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
So just be safe, guys.
Guys, if you're listening,
please be enjoyed safe. Seeing them.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
We had a few, but I think I was in bed, so.
A lot. And then I did make it till midnight this year. I usually don't, but usually we go to the beach.
Yeah,
we go stay at our golf resort place.
There's
so.
Always something fun that used to happen.
Yeah. But we didn't go, and we've been talking about going to the beach tomorrow because I have the day off, but we'll see.
Yeah, it's just not the same.
Yeah. And I like to do a couple days.
Yeah,
when we go stay.
I don't want to do like a day trip.
And then Eric's like, oh well, we're not gonna be able to do anything. Like, well...
Oh, you almost started the Eric voice and you stopped.
Come on, hon. We're not going to be able to do anything.
Babe!
Come on.
I love the Eric voice so much.
Google knows the Eric voice. It's so funny. He tries to do my voice and it never is like, I don't recognize you.
But Google recognizes you doing him.
100%.
Oh my God, that is
And then
so
also
funny.
Recognizes him trying to do me as him. So I don't know how that happened.
Oh my God.
And then I'm just like, hey, Google, blah, 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 blah. And she's like, oh, I know that. I know that bitch.
I'm sure that's what Google's saying.
She's like, I know you, girl. Well, because mine's British and his is not.
Oh, yeah. I always have mine on British. British is the best.
I mean.
Yeah.
Speaking of British, my 23andMe.
You just got me 23 your microphone. Oh, yeah. Guys, so we did 23andMe. Did we tell them this before? We
no.
did the 23andMe. We spit in the thing. And when they say, oh.
So many spits.
I was thinking that you would just put the little swab in your mouth. Oh, no. They basically give you a freaking cup to spit in.
It's a lot of
spit. I was spitting for days. And then my spit got lost out somewhere in USPS. It was sitting somewhere for like 3.5 weeks.
Well,
with zero tracking,
yeah,
mind you.
Yeah.
And then it finally updated my spit, made it safely. Mine's still being genotyped.
Spit.
But April's has been genotyped and she got her results, which is so fun.
Should I announce my results?
Why not?
Okay. So I'm
you think someone's gonna steal your DNA?
No. I'm 100% April.
Yay!
Which
I knew
they,
it.
They put it on there. April 100%. I am 99.5% European, 98.3% Northwestern European, 82% British and Irish, 8% Scandinavian, 3% French and German, 4% broadly Northwestern European, and 1.2% Eastern European, which is like Russia.
It's so cool. Also, I saw how they break out like where you are in Britain. Like,
yes.
Like each little area.
Like Manchester.
Yeah. That is so neat. I can't wait to get mine. And you'll finally have an actual relation on there.
Yeah, it'll be you.
You have a bunch of relations, actually, but they're like maybe 2.5% yeah. or something.
So
you have some second cousins.
London, Manchester, Lancashire, West Yorkshire, and South Yorkshire.
I'm contacting everyone that I'm related to that lives elsewhere, and I'm going to come stay with you guys.
Yeah, can we?
Hi, we're actually related 0.08% on 23andMe.
Third cousins, three times removed.
Can we meet?
They're going to be like, I've really been wanting to make a trip to Ireland. Can I go?
It would actually, I would not be mad if someone reached out to me, though. I mean, not to come stay with me, obviously, but, you know, if someone was like, hey, we're related, that's actually really neat.
I mean, it's not really that much of a risk. They're not coming to your house.
No, I think it'd be kind of fun. Yeah. So I'm excited to see my results.
Me too.
Yeah. So let's talk about our drink.
I want to be related to somebody famous.
They're probably, like, famous people are probably not on 23andMe.
I know, but like, not famous, but like, you know, fucking royal or some shit.
They're also not on 23andMe.
Damn it.
So all the people that you're going to be related to on 23andMe are just us. Like us.
Just ding dongs like me.
We're just, you know, nobody.
I don't know. I feel like I already know all the people I know.
You know all the people that you know. That's deep.
I mean, I know I have a lot of like cousins and stuff, but I already know who they are.
That's so true. All right, you ready for the drink now?
Oh, yeah.
Because I really want to taste it, and I'm excited for it. Oh, yeah.
This is called... Yeah. What do we call it?
Unicorn on the Run.
Oh, yeah, Unicorn on the Run.
How would you forget your own drink?
I was going to say Escaping Unicorn, but that's not it.
It's not right.
So this drink is called Unicorn on the Run because we're talking about the Unicorn Killer, and he be on the run. It's basically a candy cane cocktail. Ooh, your face looks good.
It's really good.
Is it?
I've been dying to taste it because...
Why do I keep saying fucking candy cane? It's cotton candy.
You keep saying candy cane.
Cotton candy, cotton candy.
We made our video for our Patreons and she said candy cane in that too. So if you want to see how she made this, we do post our videos. But you did a little rim of vanilla
frosting
and then put unicorn sprinkles pressed into it. So when you have a little bit of that with the drink...
Okay, good.
Describe it. I'm sorry.
Okay, so the rim, since you mentioned it, is just, I guess it's like a Pillsbury brand or Duncan Hines brand, just like packaged vanilla frosting. And it comes with the sprinkles on the top and they're unicorn sprinkles, obviously. I only rimmed half a glass because I hate being forced to have a rim.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's just like my, I don't know.
Little thing.
Don't tell me what to do, you know?
Don't know what to do.
Maybe I don't want a rim. So you just like kind of swipe it on the outside of half of it and then stick the sprinkles to it. And then I just let it sit. So it's probably sat for like 30 minutes. And then the frosting dries up. The garnish is cotton candy with some unicorn popcorn that tastes like Fruit Loops attached to the end.
They really do taste like
Fruit Loops. Okay. So then in the glass, you fill it. I mean, you basically fill it with cotton candy.
No, you had it very full because it will disintegrate.
It's like a half a cup of cotton candy probably. And the cotton candy I bought was just smashed into a bag from the grocery store.
Yeah.
So I had to like kind of pull it apart. It's like the texture of insulation from a house.
It doesn't taste like insulation.
It doesn't. So you fill it with, I chose pink.
But listen, if cotton you're candy. Really cool, like my mom, a.k.a. your aunt, you have your own machine.
What the
and
heck?
You can create this yourself and then make your cocktail.
Does she just stand in her house and just air fry stuff and make cotton candy?
Correct. Whilst looking adorable.
I wish we were there.
I digress.
Okay, so you fill it up with cotton candy and then you make your drink. So the drink is for one beverage. 1.5 ounces of plain vodka, 2 ounces of unsweetened cranberry juice, not the cranberry juice cocktail because it makes it too sweet, I think. 1/2 ounce of sweet vermouth, 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, and you shake that over ice, pour it over the cotton candy, and when you pour it over, the cotton candy all disintegrates, and then it sweetens the drink.
Okay.
Wow, you really finished that.
I literally just finished that on an empty stomach.
It was really good.
It was delicious. And if you don't mix it and you just kind of leave it the way it was after you poured it, the end drink is just like this little, I don't want to use the word sludge, but it's like kind of a thick sweetness at the end. It's a nice way to end the drink.
Ooh, that is good.
And I also want to say
that the cranberry juice is nice and bitter.
The asshole that we're talking about today does not deserve this adorable drink. Yeah, but, this guy. You know, we were excited to use unicorns, so.
I was really excited to use the unicorns.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot I have my little unicorn guy.
Oh, and she has a unicorn on her desk. And I also want to say that I hate this guy more than anything in the world.
Yeah.
I hate him. And I mean, I hate all murderers, obviously, but like this guy just really gets under my skin.
Well, and I even texted you when I started reading into, like, I was trying to figure out, like, where he was from or whatever. And I was like, oh, I can already tell I'm going to be fucking mad.
You're going to be really mad. And it was, like, one of those things where I just kept finding more and more and more shit on this guy. Ugh. And I was just like, okay, no, I have to talk about that. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. And we're going to talk today about the unicorn killer. He goes out and kills unicorns.
That seems like an imaginary activity.
Yeah, but kind of a nightmare. Mm. All right. So the sources. I used Philadelphia Inquirer. There is a book that I use called The Unicorn's Secret, Murder in the Age of Aquarius. And it was originally published in 1990. And then he did like a little update at the end, kind of like an epilogue later. There is Stephen Levy is the author. Sorry. There's an article from Conspiracies and Secret Societies. Mm. Oh, you know, you want to know all about those.
I do.
And there was a really good documentary on the ID channel also called The Unicorn, which was really cool because it had a lot of they had some footage in there from the actual, you know, police searches and things like that, which I always kind of like.
That's cool.
And then there's also a site called DailyKos.com. Daily KOS. So it's kind of like people blogging about books and things.
Oh, okay.
So Ira Samuel Einhorn was born May 15th, 1940 to a middle class Jewish family. His mother doted on him and taught him to read almost as soon as he could walk.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. She thought he was brilliant and she nurtured that in him, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. I think my kids are brilliant as well. He started playing contract bridge on an adult level before he hit junior high, pretty much proving to everyone that he was a mini genius. Mm. Apparently bridge is like the hardest of the common games to learn to play.
Okay.
So I read. I have no idea. I've actually never played bridge. It just sounds like an old people game to me.
It's an old lady game.
Yeah, it's an old lady game. But I mean, you had to be pretty smart to play it, I guess. Mm. So you're playing it at 12 with adults. You know, people think you're pretty smart. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of started, you know, his youth kind of started this life of getting away with pretty much anything he wanted. And everyone who met little Ira was convinced that he was not only intelligent, but transcendent. And the normal rules of behavior did not really apply to him. And you're going to see a theme of that throughout his life. It's
just
very
because he could play bridge?
Fucking interesting.
No. Be like, hey, your kid's an asshole.
It's because
I don't care if he can play bridge or not.
It's because he's a con man, and he's a really good one.
Right.
So the high school administration let him attend the prom in a flannel shirt and jeans, which is a big deal in the 50s. Okay, this is the 50s. College professors excused absence after absence as long as Ira produced a decent term paper at the end of the semester. So he would, like, just basically not even show up to class, but just, like, turn in a paper. Hmm. They'd be like, oh, my God, you have brilliance. There was a mentor who gave him a key to his home and bounced groundbreaking academic theories off of him, even though he was barely in his 20s. Like, people just thought his brain was so amazing.
Okay.
One of his high school teachers said, quote, I ought to wring that boy's neck, but I cannot deny the world, Ira. It was like he truly bewitched people.
Weird.
And it started when he was young. He went to college at the University of Pennsylvania in the 1960s at the start of the free love movement, and he really found his niche. He was a big man, scruffy, with a beard and wild hair. He had what some people called hypnotic blue eyes. He was really into writing poetry and contemplating his navel and all that shit, which reminds me of my dad.
Contemplating his navel?
My dad used to say that to me. Are you going to go contemplate your navel? Yeah. So anyway, it's just about being all deep and introspective and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So he
those guys that play the acoustic guitar and make eye contact with you the whole time.
Which is kind of creepy.
They're
and
fucking
not
creeps.
I want to leave.
Yeah.
Just play the guitar. Look elsewhere. So he was an environmental activist who advocated for flower power, peace, and free love to his fellow students at the university. And apparently he also smelled, because, you know, bathing was so 1950s. Like, I guess people didn't really...
Who said that he smelled?
I don't know. My mom told me that... Okay, I'm not a child of the 60s, so if you are listening to this, I don't know, but... Mom was definitely a child of the 60s, and she told me there was actually a perfume that smelled like dirt. And I think there is still some stuff out there. I kind of think patchouli smells like dirt.
It smells 100% like dirt.
But yeah, there was an actual perfume that smelled like dirt because people like to smell of the earth.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. I don't, I like fresh cream.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the opposite of the earth.
Yeah. So yeah, he also just never really bathed. He was just too busy being introspective.
So there's just like, I feel like there's just a funk.
Yeah. So he also claimed to have been instrumental in creating Earth Day in 1970 and participated in the Earth Day rally in Philadelphia that year. But other organizers of Earth Day have disputed this account. But he definitely was a part of it. I'm not sure exactly how much he was a part of it, but he definitely was.
He was at least there.
He was, yeah, he was, and he probably did have some, you know, influence on creating it. And can I just say, and this might be an unpopular opinion with some people out there, but free love was just really a stupid fucking way of getting into more people's pants.
I agree.
I mean, I'm all about being liberated sexually, but this no holds bar stuff was really exploited by a lot of people. And I think a lot of people got hurt. And I think a lot of women got hurt because I feel like they felt like they had to give in to this free love bullshit when they didn't really want to.
Right.
From 1964 through 1968, the rates of syphilis and gonorrhea in California rose 165%.
Wow. So people weren't being safe.
They weren't being safe. I don't think it was even something that people thought about.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of this was fueled by drug use, right, obviously.
Yeah.
For the flower children of the 1960s, the age of Aquarius meant a time of free love, drugs, and war protests. And I'm not against all of that. I mean, if you want to peacefully protest war, I think that's the great thing about America. We should have the right to do that. But yeah, no, I'm not about the drug use.
Yeah. Well, or I think free love. Anytime you put, I don't want to say freedoms on something. Anytime you put like that sort of a thing out there, you're always going to get predators.
Yeah, that's exactly
That's
where they go.
It's like people are surprised that, you know, pedophiles are basketball coaches. Well, why do you think they're basketball coaches?
Exactly. Because they want to be near the children.
Yeah, it's like it breeds predators.
It does.
Not that everyone's a predator, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. So Einhorn pretty much represented everything about the counterculture movement of the 1960s, and he was charismatic as fuck. Mm. And I'm going to post pictures of him. This dude was not good looking.
No.
At any point in his life.
No. Especially in his old age.
Yeah. And I mean, I kind of understand the allure during the 60s of he was very opposite of what the 50s were, and a lot of people his age liked that. And there was a lot of movements happening during that time.
Right.
But I mean, you might feel different if you sat in a room with him. Maybe he was charismatic as fuck. Obviously, he was something, as we'll see.
Wasn't that kind of the Charlie Manson thing?
Totally. Yeah. Same. Yeah, totally.
Same deal.
So he actually nicknamed himself the Unicorn because his last name, Einhorn, means one horn in German. Hmm. And also he loved that because he really saw himself as a mysterious and magical dude. Yeah, he saw himself as a lot of things. Your face right now, if only people can see. So he graduated in 1961, but he remained an active member of the Pennsylvania and Philadelphia communities throughout the 60s and 70s. At age 25, he founded the Free University course, which was a movement that offered an alternative to formal education with courses like Third World Liberation and Tantric Sex. Because you know you want to take a class on Tantric Sex. That's shit you need to learn about to succeed in this world.
It's really important.
Which I don't know why the word tantric just really bothers me. Like, why does it have to be a tantric sex? Just have some sex. I don't know.
I mean, I guess if you're having sex with everybody, you have to make it a little bit more exciting.
I guess. You have to be meditative. I think that's what tantric sex is all about.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm dumb. I don't know all these different sexes, people. I had to look it up, okay?
We're just good with regular sex.
It's good with regular sex. All right. So Einhorn had a large and diverse following. he was chummy with very prominent people like Allen Ginsberg. And if you don't know who Allen Ginsberg is or was, he was a writer and poet and also part of the Beat Generation with Jack Kerouac. Mm-hmm. Which I actually did love Jack Kerouac's book, but yeah. But he vigorously opposed militarism, economic materialism, and sexual repression, which, okay, we shouldn't be sexually repressed. That, I mean, it's like the pendulum just swings so far yes, each way.
That's the predator.
Yeah, and he embodied aspects of the counterculture with his views on drugs and hostility to bureaucracy. Mm. And there's validity in a lot of the things.
Yes.
There really is. And I think, in a way, that's kind of what happens when there's so much oppression in the mm-hmm. 50s. And then, like I said, the pendulum just swings so far the other direction. Mm-hmm. And it's like, there has to be a happy medium somewhere. So this was...
Well, we're not there yet.
Yeah. And all this stuff is like right up Einhorn's dirty little alley. You know, he loved being around those people who were well-known and basically famous.
He was also... He thinks he's very important.
Well, oh, he did. He was also chummy with Grateful Dead's Jerry Garcia
oh.
and radical activist Abby Hoffman. So he was definitely running with the in crowd at the time. People had described Einhorn as magnetic and charming. Penn history professor Michael Zuckerman was a friend and classmate of Einhorn's in high school and college, and later they were colleagues at the university. And he said that Einhorn had a streak that was, quote, clearly powerful, violent, experimental, and keen to feelings and emotions. He also said that, quote, Einhorn wanted to experience life at its most intense, and this included violence.
So he was an asshole. That sounds 100%. Like shorthand for that.
Yes.
He was very intense and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
He felt things passionately.
Right.
No, he was an ass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That means he can't control himself.
Yeah. He was constantly pushing the limits. There are countless stories of Einhorn putting his hand in fire, like when he was in high school and college, and betting people how long he could keep it there. What an idiot.
Okay.
There are also episodes of allegedly attacking girlfriends, which Zuckerman says were not a pattern of behavior to Einhorn, but rather an experiment. Everything is an experiment to him. I want to have an experiment on culture, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Let me beat people and experiment on that. He also ran for mayor in 1971 and taught at the university for a time. So he was getting fucking jobs, okay?
How the fuck did he teach at a university?
He got a job there. He was actually paid to talk about his brilliance.
That's weird.
Yeah. So some of the city's leading companies actually paid him for what he called his, quote, far watcher thoughts.
What?
Like, I'm so brilliant and all-knowing, I can provide this insight to you and you can pay me for it.
Oh, like I'm a... clairvoyant or something?
Yeah, fuck off, Ira. Okay. But the establishment loved him and were fascinated by him. And also, I read that it was popular to have kind of a hippie around in the 70s to have it look like you kind of you have your finger on the pulse. Man.
We're yeah. cool.
Like, I know we're like, you know,
we're the establishment.
We're the establishment, but like, we have this hippie guy here. Yeah. And how
and
cool
he
is
likes
that?
Us, so we're cool.
Yeah, he never had money. But others just picked up the tab all the time, and he was literally being paid to be himself, which was very influencer of him, honestly. I was thinking,
if this
like,
guy had Instagram.
Well, I mean, Instagram people are basically being paid to be themselves. So, I mean, true. Okay. That's fine. Like, you know, this part is fine. If that's how you were living your life or whatever, the violence is the part that's not fine.
Right.
You know, and he was a sociopath. Yeah. He really was. He was able to show his persona in person and really make people think that he was somebody else.
Well, and he thinks he's smarter than everybody.
Oh, absolutely.
I was listening to something today, side tangent but related. I listen to Jordan Peterson sometimes. He's like a psychologist professor.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that... at some point in all of our lives, we'll be affected by a psychopath.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He said the reason, like how you know, is that the psychopath will treat you badly because they're trying to save you from being treated badly, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
So
like,
they're
this is
showing
for your
you,
own good.
Yes. They're yeah, showing yeah. you oh, this sorry. Is what someone will do when they treat you badly, but they'll just treat you badly and think that they're doing you a favor
right.
because you're too stupid to figure out that you're being treated badly.
Yeah. Well, they're smarter than you.
Yeah.
Don't you know?
Apparently.
Jesus. So he, Einhorn also wrote a truly bizarre book in 1972 called 781-187880.
What the fuck?
Okay. So remember at the beginning I talked about my sources, Daily Kos. Mm-hmm. So a blogger by the name of Elid, I think it's Elid or Elid, E-L-L-I-D. She wrote a really interesting review about this book, which is kind of where I got most of my information. It's worth the read because she actually shows photos, because you can't get this book online. Like, you have to buy it. Oh. You can buy it on eBay. I think it's like, I don't know, $70. I'm not giving money to any of this shit. So, I didn't do that, but she shows pictures of the book. And I also enjoyed reading her other reviews because she does a lot of obscure things. So go check her out. But anyway, this book, Ira wanted it to be published with no title because he felt that the mix of wild graphics, unique font designed to emulate his printing, and free associative poetry / rant / rap / philosophizing didn't need a title. Readers would get it or they wouldn't get it.
He's so pompous.
He's so pompous, right? But the Anchor Book staff, sales staff, actually pointed out to him that they need to have something to put on the order form. It has to be
listed as something.
Yeah, or no one would be able to order the book. So he's like,
book.
Oh, okay, man. So he agreed to let it be known by its Library of Congress number. So if you don't know what a Library of Congress number is, a Library of Congress catalog control number is a unique identification number that the Library of Congress assigns to the catalog record created for each book in its cataloged collections. So he basically was just like, this is some random shit in an ass number that I was assigned. We'll just use that.
Couldn't you have come up with something better?
No. He's too transcendent for that, man. Like, this is 1972. I was -1 year old.
I could write all the shit in this book, but I refuse to come up with a title, so I'm going to call it some numbers.
Yeah, and okay. It's full of pictures that make no sense. There's like a beheaded Barbie.
Okay.
And then he's got his ramblings in there.
So it's like an avant-garde art book.
It is so fucking stupid. I have no words. Like, I'm sorry, the 70s. Go home. Like, I hate it. The first page says, I'm just going to read you this. This will just give you an impression of the whole thing, and then I'm just going to move on. The first page says, quote, I am the product of all the impressions received since I began recording, and my essence, which is in the process of purification, thus my eyes, and eyes as in, you know, the letter I.
Oh.
Yeah. Thus my eyes. Thank those who touched me and left an impression. And then it says, my memory. So I'm not sure if that was a typo. It's like memory with an M-E in front of it. All one word.
Me memory?
Me memory. Me memory. Whose use I need to go beyond in questing after essence, to which work in this book is dedicated.
Okay, bro.
What the fuck are you talking about, dude?
He has no clue.
But we don't understand because we're not as transcendent
as him.
Is
he like laughing in the background? Like, people are going to really think this is fucking profound.
I think he's probably been laughing his entire life behind everyone's back.
He's like, people are going to think this is really something and I'm just making this shit up.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of charisma this guy had, it's just, and you would think like, oh, I would never be taken in by someone like that. But you know what? Some really fucking smart people have been taken in by that.
Well, and also, he's not looking for you.
Yeah.
He's looking for the people who will be taken in by it.
That's true.
You're the wrong one.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm the wrong one.
That's the thing about sociopaths. A lot of them are really born in the perfect time to do the things that they did. Like, if you say, okay, well, if this was 2020, he wouldn't be able to do this.
No, he'd pick a different con.
Right? Just like Hitler. If he was born in this time, these things wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. Of course, then you got other people who are born in this time and things do happen. So it's, they know how to conform.
Right.
Okay. Ira.
Ira.
Ira. He was living the high life and had generous gifts from wealthy benefactors and even from members of influential corporate structures who believed the all-knowing and brilliant Ira, god of the flower children, had a secret that they could exploit into big books. Hmm. And he really was the god of the flower children. People really basically worshipped him. It's kind of scary. So Einhorn apparently had a gabillion tea girlfriends, but in 1972, he met Helen Holly Maddox. And he is such a fucking schmuck. Okay, she's having coffee. He went up to her and commented on the book she was reading because she's extremely smart. I'm going to say this. She graduated with an English degree, so she's a reader. She's in a coffee shop. She's reading. He goes up to her and says, "You must have a beautiful mind." And then said, "Oh, I didn't realize from so far that you were so beautiful as well, because I'm already in love with your mind." I'm going to puke. I'll just throw up in my mouth.
Yeah.
Okay. But it worked.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I'm not saying I haven't been taken in by some lines too, okay? This is not me judging at all. Because obviously he had a way about him, you know? And he was known in Philadelphia. Mm. He was basically a famous figure at this point.
Celebrity.
Yeah, he was. So Holly was born May 26, 1947 to Fred and Liz Maddox. She was raised in a conservative household and her father was a World War II veteran. She was the oldest of five siblings and grew up in Tyler, Texas, so a small town. Mm. Her siblings described her as the ideal big sister. She included them when she was with her friends. She taught her sister how to swim. They were close and they loved her a lot. Holly was the all-American girl. She was a cheerleader in her Texas high school and class salutatorian. I knew I couldn't say that word.
Salutatorian.
Guess what? I was never a salutatorian, but Holly was. So she was very smart. She was also voted most likely to succeed in high school. Remember those dumb votes that people used to do in high school?
Vaguely.
Yeah. She was also a talented dancer. And like most teenagers, she was not always in agreement with her parents' values, and she disagreed with the ultra-conservative atmosphere. And she really wanted to spread her wings, experience new things. She was kind of a free spirit. And it's that, you know, that perfect storm of that time when your parents are a World War II veteran, we're from the 50s, and we're very conservative. And
right.
You're a teenager, and you're like, I'm going to experience the world, and I disagree with everything, which is totally normal.
Right.
Even now, it's completely normal. So she wanted something more than what her small town in Texas offered, and she wanted adventure in her life. Who doesn't? I want adventure, too. So after graduating high school, she attended the prestigious Bryn Mawr College near Philadelphia, and she graduated with an English degree in 1971. And when she met Einhorn, he introduced her to an exciting new life filled with travel and rallies and parties. I mean, think about how that must have been for her, you know.
Just coming from a small town in Texas and...
Yep. And then now all of a sudden
she meets this guy and it opens up her
world.
Yeah.
And the movers and shakers at that time. Big deal. She was fully charmed by him, and within a few days, they were living together. It did not take long. Wow. Yeah. So Einhorn was a lecturer at Harvard and was a famous Philadelphian, like I said. He also had, I mean, a lecturer at Harvard. Like, already you're like, oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, you don't think some sociopathic, pompous ass is doing it.
Right.
But it's like, why are you, I don't know. It's just so odd. When you read it now, it's so easy in retrospect to read it now and be like, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, but at the time, it didn't sound or seem like bullshit. He had a very strong personality, which I've obviously shown you. And Holly was shy and sweet. And I think Einhorn's personality just basically engulfed her.
Right.
It was like she was caught up in this Einhorn wave and it just carried her wherever he wanted it to carry her, mm-hmm. you know. So living together was not the business, especially for her conservative father. And around that time, they did not speak.
Oh.
Yeah, he was not happy with that. But she did correspond with her mother through letters. So there was that. And she did keep in contact with her siblings, and she was close with them. So over the next 5 years, their relationship was stormy and abusive.
5 years?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. Her family did not like Einhorn at all. Her sister Elizabeth Hall said that, quote, when he did come down and spend time in their home, he was rude and he was overbearing to Holly and ordered her around.
Usually, side note to all the people that are in relationships, usually that's a red flag. Sometimes, yeah. Okay, I will say some people have shitty families and sometimes people are not liked because your family is bad. You know that about your family.
That's true.
However, If you are dating somebody or in a relationship with somebody and your whole family is like, we do not like this person, maybe take the hint. If yeah. they probably know something or have realized something that you don't.
Yeah.
Know.
Especially if you feel like, you know, there could be violence or yeah. something like that.
Especially if they're like, I feel like you're in danger. This guy is rude and seems violent and is intense.
Yeah.
And passionate.
Yeah. The intense and passionate.
Yeah. If your family is warning you, they're just looking out for you.
And I'm going to post some pictures of Holly. She was fucking gorgeous. Yeah. She was so beautiful. And it actually is so heartbreaking to think that she stayed in this relationship for so long, thinking that she didn't have the strength to leave, thinking that she wasn't good enough. It was almost like she really had to build her confidence. And you think, you look at someone like that and think, you are so smart. You graduated from this prestigious college. You're beautiful. Like, why would you
yeah,
not?
Yeah, you're like literally a mom.
But it's such a commentary yeah. on women in general. Like, I just want to say that. Like, you are beautiful. You are smart. You are worthy. You are all those things. But we just don't see it.
No. And you don't deserve to be abused.
No. And it's just.
In any way.
No. So it's just, it's so mind-boggling when you look at someone else and think, how could they have felt that way?
Yeah.
You know, well, from the outside human. Looking in, it's always easy. Yeah. But. I just wanted to say that.
Because I just mean, if your family tips you off to something, they're usually oh, yeah. right.
Oh, totally.
Especially your mom.
Yeah.
Because moms know what's
especially
up.
Especially your mom, right? Moms do know what's up.
Uh-huh.
That's why my mom... Now I'm getting off on a side tangent. She doesn't actually call any of my ex-boyfriends by their names. They all have a weird name, like the pie guy. Oh. This is the guy that showed up with pies at Thanksgiving. Or this is the guy. And it was just always like, didn't like the pie guy.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't like... And it's like, okay, mom... I wonder if the pie guy will ever listen to this. Hi, pie guy. I'm not going to say your real name. He would know who he was, though.
Yeah. My mom met a boyfriend that I had once. We went out to dinner. And pretty simple question. He was kind of a weirdo. Didn't date him for very long. She's like, so what do you like to do? And he kind of didn't really have an answer. And mom was just like, that's it?
That's it?
Yeah. He's like, well, I like to go to movies with my friends or whatever he said. And she's like, okay, like, do you like sports? Do you watch baseball? Like, what else?
That's that was it. All I had.
He's like, you go to the movies with your you. Friends. She's like, okay.
Maybe she made him nervous.
Maybe. She kind of makes me nervous sometimes.
Exactly.
But then afterwards, she was like, no. He doesn't even have any, he doesn't even do anything. He doesn't have any hobbies.
Oh my God. I feel like I have no hobbies now.
You do this.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Hi. Welcome to
Hi,
my hobby.
Welcome to the hobby.
All right, so moving on, Holly. So Holly and her friend Andrea Boyce worked together at the local co-op, and Andrea later stated that she remembers a morning when they were stocking the store together and she noticed a mark on Holly's neck. She asked Holly about it, and Holly told her that Ira had put the marks there. Yeah. So also during this relationship, Einhorn was 100% not faithful.
Of course
because,
not.
Because, you know, he was just free so magnetic love, and free love and all that shit. They did break up multiple times, but Einhorn always managed to get her to come back, which is the typical scenario
right.
and cycle.
Yeah.
So in the summer of 1977, Holly went to her friend Joyce Petchek's peach house on Fire Island. And I had no idea where Fire Island was, but apparently it's a remote, secluded island which is off the south coast of Long Island, New York. You got to have moolah to have a house there.
Yeah.
It is it you and you can't even get there by road. You have to take a boat.
I think it's like a party place.
Yeah, I mean rich people live there. And Joyce was a mutual friend of Holly's and Ira's. And there's a shit ton of Joyce. Like if you want to read this book by Stephen Levy, I highly suggest it. He goes really deep into stuff about this woman. I'm not going to go into all that, but she was a mutual friend of theirs. Holly did go hang out there. And while on this little getaway in the summer of 1977, she meets Saul Lapidus. And Saul is tall, clean cut, well dressed, put together. He's the literal opposite of Einhorn, who's basically a fucking hot mess and stinks, okay? I mean, honestly, look at the photos. And they hit it off really quickly, and they made plans to keep seeing each other. In September 1977, Holly, who's now 30, she's been with him for 5 years. Mm-hmm. She'd had enough, and she told Einhorn she was leaving his ass.
Good.
And I'm sure meeting Saul was kind of the last little nudge that she needed. And again,
like,
in this
book. Oh, there are other people out there who
yes.
like me and appreciate me.
And again, in this book, he goes very deeply into kind of this lead up to her leaving him. And she, you know, cut her hair, and she, like, she was doing things to make herself feel good about herself. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Einhorn saw that. He was like, you know, it's kind of like when couples, like, one of them loses weight and then all of a sudden the other one doesn't like it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what was going on, except she was leading up to leaving him. She was building her confidence for a while to do this. And so she met this man and she really liked him. And I think that was really the last nudge that she needed. She was like, I'm out. So she decides she's going to leave Einhorn September 1977 and then just disappears. No calls, nothing. No one hears from her. In September 1977, her family files a missing persons report because they're like, what's going on? We haven't heard from Holly, blah, blah, blah. Months went by. No one heard from her. Her mother's birthday came and went with no call from Holly, and they knew something was really wrong because she would not call her mother, you know,
on,
like,
her birthday.
She was a good daughter. Like, you know, she wanted to be a good daughter, and she would not have done that. I mean, could you imagine just not calling your mom on her birthday or seeing your mom or something? Yeah. I mean, unless you have a terrible relationship, but that wasn't the case. So Einhorn had told Holly's mother and the police that she broke up with him and he never saw her again. I don't know, man. She broke up with me, never saw her again. That was that. Yeah. So sorry you can't find her, but blah, blah, blah. So for 18 months, Holly's parents, three sisters, and her brother in Texas were desperate to find her. They felt certain that Einhorn had played a major role in her disappearance. So Holly's family reaches out to a retired FBI agent turned private investigator.
Hell yeah.
Who lived in Texas by the name of Bob Stevens. I know. That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
He begins an investigation with another retired FBI agent from Philadelphia named J.R. Pierce. And Pierce's first stop was the apartment of Ira fucking Einhorn.
Duh.
Yep.
Ground zero.
Yeah. Ira was like, geez, guys, I have no idea where Holly went. Bummer you can't find her. I mean, I'm involved in so many important humanitarian projects for the city of Philadelphia. I literally do not even have time for this. Like, that's kind of how he was.
Okay.
He gave the same song and dance he fed Holly's mother and the police previously. I don't know. She broke up with me. Never saw her again. But this time he added another little tidbit to his story. Oh, you know what? Holly probably went to a commune in India. Okay.
Could be.
Could be. Pierce and Stevens were like, okay, we'll take that information. So now they start interviewing every person who had any contact with Holly around that time. They speak with a friend of hers by the name of Jeannie Berman. And Jeannie had an apartment that was available for rent, and Holly had agreed to rent it. So she had literally
she had plans.
She was making her plans. Like, I'm going to rent this apartment. So I'm leaving him.
My question is, when you file a missing persons report, the cops in New York or in Philadelphia are just like, well, who knows? We checked the boyfriend. He hasn't seen her.
It's the 1970s. Number one. Number two, I think missing persons reports for adults are not as readily investigated,
probably.
Not as quickly investigated. And I think that they probably were under the assumption that she just left. I mean, this was kind of the time when people just, they would go to communes.
That's true.
You know?
And they were probably hitchhiking.
And I think she had been at communes before. So okay. It's kind of like, okay, well, maybe that could be. There's literally no evidence. Right. And, you know, they talked to him, they looked into it, and I think they had nothing. So, you know, I'm not blaming them in any way. I think it's just one of those things. Yeah. So they reached out to the FBI. Oh, yeah. They were talking to Jeannie. Mm-hmm. So Jeannie had this apartment, and Holly had agreed to rent it. She'd even given Holly keys, and she was actually upset because she thought Holly had basically gypped her, like stiffed her and skipped out. Because she's like, I gave her these keys, she was going to rent it, and now nothing.
Oh.
Like, she never rented it. She never came to talk to me. So Jeannie also tells them that Holly had been spending time on Fire Island with Joyce Petchek. And when they speak with Joyce, she says, oh yes, she was definitely here. It's so sad that no one can find her. But just know that I recently contacted a medium who told me that she went to a commune in India. So everything's fine.
So your medium was Ira?
Also, I thought mediums talk to dead people. Clairvoyance might be the right term, but anyway, whatever.
Like a psychic. So you talked to her ex-boyfriend? Because who else would come up with a comedy?
They must have.
Yeah.
Yeah. They can't. Yeah, exactly. I mean, in light of this in light of this information, this investigation is closed. We're done. Thank you so much, Joyce. You're fucking wackadoo.
Yeah.
But she also does tell them about Saul, because they didn't know about Saul.
Okay.
Who Holly was seeing, who not only had a place on Fire Island, so he was, you know, a rich dude.
Rich.
But he also had an apartment in Manhattan, so he's double rich.
So she had probably been there.
Absolutely. So Pierce goes to Manhattan to speak with Saul. And Saul says they had this whirlwind romance over the course of what he called a few magical weeks. He said he last saw her on his boat. He also has a boat. Hello, dudes. Also rich. Triple rich. Well,
he's got to get to his house on the island.
That's right. Oh, God, that's right. Thank you. I forgot. So he said he last saw her on his boat when Holly got a phone call from Ira. And just remember, this is the 1970s. No one's calling your cell phone, okay? Somehow Ira got Saul's boat number, which just kind of shows probably what connections he had. First of all, he probably found out about Saul from Joyce. Right. This is just me conjecturing, people, okay? I don't actually know this. I didn't see this part. It could be in Stephen Levy's book, and I just skipped over that. I don't know. But he ends up getting the number to Saul's boat and calls her, knowing she's on this boat, okay?
Wait, like a boat phone?
Yeah, he had a boat phone.
Now you can get a boat phone.
Apparently you can.
If you're rich.
I mean, if you're docked, I guess you could. I don't know, whatever.
I was thinking like a ham radio.
No, I think this is just like a boat phone number.
Huh.
Yeah. So Holly speaks with Ira, and Saul tells them it's a loud and volatile conversation. She tells Saul that Ira is pissed off that she's leaving him. No kidding. And also pissed off she's there with him. So he knew that she was there. And threatened to throw her clothes, her driver's license, and her bank statements out the window. Like, he's basically like, I'm throwing all your shit out. Fuck okay. You. Blah, blah, blah. So she told Saul, I'm going to go get my things.
Right.
Well, he was concerned, and he asked her if she was sure she should go.
He should have gone with her.
I know. It's very easy to Monday morning quarterback.
Yeah.
Which I hate that term, but it's true. He should have, but he didn't because she probably, I mean, he said, are you sure you should go? She was adamant. She's like, no, I'm fine. Everything's fine. I can deal with it. I'm going to go calm him down. I'm going to go. So, I mean, he probably was like, okay, I mean, if you don't want me to go, I'm not going to go.
Right.
He wasn't going to force it. But at this point, you know, Pierce is like, well, is Saul lying? Is he telling the truth? I mean, he could say a lot of things. I don't know if this is true, right? Mm-hmm. So he was definitely a suspect at this point. But they need more answers. So they return to Philadelphia to continue gathering information. In March 1979, they end up speaking to a group of Drexel students who used to rent the apartment directly below Einhorn. They say that there had been a terrible odor coming from the upstairs apartment above their closet area. Oh. It was so bad they thought maybe an animal had crawled into the walls and died. Also, a sickening brown stain appeared on the ceiling and a strange fluid began leaking down. I know. Disgusting.
I hate it.
They also remember vividly Ira and Holly arguing, and one night, a very loud thud on the ceiling of their apartment. Private Detective Pierce decided it was time to speak to the police, because he was certain he'd found the information that was needed in the case.
Right.
He was like, okay, we found something. I'm going to go. Right. And also, Saul ended up taking a polygraph, because they're like, you know what? Come in. Let's rule you out, dude. He took it and he passed, so now they're looking at the fucking unicorn.
Right.
Because they're like, okay, well, you know, not that you can put 100% stock in a polygraph, but I think it was just, we didn't really think you did it anyway.
Right. It gives them some assurance.
Right.
To not look at you anymore.
Yeah. So on Wednesday, March 28th, 1979, at approximately 8:50 in the morning, investigating officers, including Detective Michael Chitwood, arrived at Einhorn's apartment and rang the buzzer. And this jerk just nonchalantly answered the door naked. He's all about the nakedness.
Ew.
And was like, hey guys, what's up? Just hate him so much. Chitwood gave him the search warrant and told him they were there to search for any evidence related to the disappearance of Holly Maddox. And Ira told him to say, I've not seen her since September 1977. She went out to do some shopping at the nearby food co-op and never came back. I don't know. Broke up with me. Blah, 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 dudes. Mm-hmm. You know, I have no.
And they're like, actually, we know exactly where to look, so please move.
That's exactly what happened. Yeah. Yep. They showed up with crowbars and other tools and were ready to rip up the floors if needed. Mm-hmm. He offered no resistance as the officers began to search for the source of the offensive odor and the mysterious brown stain. Detective Chitwood, knowing, like you said, he knew exactly where to go. He went directly to the bedroom closet.
He's like, we don't need to flip over your couch, bro.
Yeah, we know what we're looking for. Yeah, he went to the bedroom closet based on the information provided by the downstairs neighbors. And there was a padlock on it.
On the closet.
Hmm. So he's like, and if you watch the ID episode, The Unicorn Killer, you can hear the Mr. Chitwood, Detective Chitwood, talk about this. It's so funny because he's just like, so I just asked him, like, hey, you got the keys for this? It's just so funny how he tells it. And Einhorn's like, nah, I got the keys. Like, who locks their closet and doesn't have keys? Because at first I'm like, well, who the fuck locks their closet? But then I'm like, okay, well, maybe if you have a lot of guests over and you have, like, money in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, I can think of a million reasons why you'd want to lock it.
Right.
Not that you're hiding something horrific.
I can't think of any reason why you wouldn't have the keys to
that. Yeah. I can't think of any reason why you wouldn't have the keys. And, you know, he was just standing there. I think he put a robe on at some point, but he's just standing there.
Just with his balls out.
He's just like, hey, guys, I'm naked. So, yeah, Detective Chitwood said, do you have any keys? And he's like, nah, I don't got the keys. So he's like, fine. So they broke the lock with the cutters, which they brought. And the closet is packed with boxes, stacked one on top of the other. And, again, if you watch the ID episode, you can see an actual picture of this. Because I always like to visually see things. I'm like, oh, so that's how the closet looked. Okay. So they started removing the boxes one at a time. After a few boxes, they find a woman's purse. Okay. It was Holly's, of course. Mm-hmm. It had her driver's license in it, all her personal items. You know, all the things you would actually need if you were going to fucking go to India for a commune or anywhere.
Yeah.
Like, you can't just leave without all of these things. No. Right?
No.
So they keep removing items and they find a large steamer trunk underneath all these boxes. And as they're pulling out the trunk, they find a bunch of newspapers dated September 1977. What a coincidence. That's exactly when she went missing.
Yeah. How did you just piece this together perfectly for
that? Jesus. So, so they start opening the trunk and inside was the mummified body of a woman whose skull had been crushed.
Oh, God.
Yeah. The odor and the brownish fluid were coming from her decomposing corpse.
Of course.
The body was obviously that of the missing Holly Maddox, and she had been bludgeoned to death. Wow, guys. I have no idea how that got there. That smell? I don't even smell anything. This is so crazy. How did this get here?
Are you fucking kidding
me? I don't even understand this. And then Chitwood said, quote, it looks like we found Holly. And Einhorn said to him, quote, you found who you found.
Does he think that's like a defensible argument? Like, are you pleading the fifth? It's in your fucking closet.
You piece of shit. Like, oh, that's so deep. You found who you found.
Yeah.
I'm so transcendent. I mean, I just.
She's the person of the apartment now.
She is of this apartment.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's disgusting. So the medical examiner stated that Holly's skull had been crushed and she had been beaten with a blunt object. Her autopsy report read, quote, blunt impacts to head, 6+. Comminuted. I even looked up this word. God damn it. I am not an autopsy person. Okay. Comminuted, depressed skull fractures, contusions to scalp and face. And comminuted means broken into three or more sections.
Fuck.
Just so you know. The outline of one fracture resembled the mark that would have been left by a 2x4 board.
Fuck.
It was a brutal attack. Attacked the shit out of her. Yeah. So on the day of
I'm surprised the downstairs neighbors didn't.
Well, they heard the thud. The cops. I think it's one of those things where.
You got your music turned up. You're not really paying attention.
It's like, I know I talked about this in another episode. Lululemon murder. They literally heard the girl screaming for like 10 minutes and didn't. Oh, I just thought it was some people fight. Like, nobody calls anybody.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, I don't know what it was like in the 70s. I mean, I was 4 when this happened. So, but yeah, just call. We've said this before. Like,
I just sent Eric over there.
If you hear a big thud, Just, yeah, just do it.
I have sent Eric over the neighbor's house before.
You have?
Mm-hmm.
What if they were violent?
I guess we're going to find out.
You're just going to send him into the lion's den?
No.
Go not check to it like, out, sweetie.
Not to like go in the house, but at least knock on the door.
Yeah.
And pull somebody outside.
True.
You know?
Yeah.
At least like let them know, hey, we fucking hear you.
Right.
If there's a problem, we'll call the cops right now.
That's true. Yeah. I still advocate for not going over there and calling the cops, but I'm a wuss, so.
I'm crazy.
You are. Well, you make Eric be crazy.
I'm kind of crazy. And then I'm like standing at the porch, like glaring at him.
I can see you.
We see you.
I see you. So on the day of his bail hearing, a multitude of high profile character witnesses appeared in court to vouch for him. Einhorn's attorney, future Senator Arlen Specter, and former DA of Philadelphia, so he had some high-powered friends, managed to get bail set that required only $4,000 in cash.
Oh my gosh, I was so fucking mad when I read that.
Yeah.
I was like, how? How?
Yeah.
You literally have a decomposed body in mm-hmm. your closet of your girlfriend that you murdered. I mean, hook, line, and sinker, we got you, bud. And
yeah.
Then you get let out on bail.
It's crazy. I mean, it's pretty common for someone who has been arrested for first degree murder to be held without bail.
Yes.
Yeah. But not the unicorn. After all, a high priest of peace, love, and harmony, which is basically how they saw
him. Do it, man.
But he could be trusted to remain in Philadelphia so that he might clear things up for his trial.
Of course.
It's absolutely mind-blowing how all these high-powered and prominent people assisted him. All of these people, bank managers, ministers, lawyers, they all came to testify at his bail hearing as a character witness, and they all said he was such an amazing, upstanding person. It's almost like he gave them all drugs.
Or had blackmail.
It's crazy. You never know.
Hey, I mean, high-profile people like to go to those crazy kind of parties like that.
It's true. Reverend David Gracie, an Episcopal minister and once the urban missioner for the Episcopal Diocese of Pennsylvania, described Einhorn's character as, quote, excellent. He's a man of nonviolence.
Okay. I hope you eat your words.
Well, yeah, I hope he has by now.
Yeah.
The DA's office argued that he was a serious flight risk. Because the DA ain't got no eyes closed.
Yeah, the DA is like, what the fuck are you guys doing? It's
like, are you all on like some kind of psychedelic trip here?
Yeah.
And they also argued that he had connections in other countries and should be held without bail.
Yeah.
You cannot trust him to stay.
Yeah.
So Einhorn had plenty to say to his supporters and to the media to clear things up. According to one of his stories, he didn't know Holly's body was decomposing there in the steamer trunk in his bedroom closet. He hadn't seen her after she told him the relationship was over and left him. She had obviously been murdered by agents of a secret government conspiracy and her body brought to his apartment and hidden there to frame him. Isn't this obvious, people? Can't you see I've been framed?
Okay. Goodbye, Einhorn.
Then there's another
you
story.
Fucking asshole.
Here's another one he liked. He had returned to his apartment one day and already found her murdered. She'd been killed by either the FBI or the CIA and left there to frame him, fearing that no one could believe him and accepting the sad fact, well, it's too late to help Holly now. He hid her body in the trunk. During the investigation, investigators found diaries he had written that went back literal years. I mean, we're talking thousands of pages.
Because he's so important, he has to get all his thoughts out on paper.
Yeah.
Yes.
Every day he did it.
Right.
And it really showcased the dark side he had. So one entry stated, quote, "To beat a woman, what joy flows through your body. To commit an act of violence to kill the one you love." Yeah. It's like you don't even know what to say. That's just one little snippet of all of this. They also found diaries from Holly. So she kept diaries as well. That solidified the belief that she was abused. He was sexually aggressive and he was violent. Mm-hmm. Also, guys, if you're going to commit a crime, don't keep diaries.
Yeah, what the fuck?
Burn them. I read so many things where it's like, and then we found the diaries or the manifesto or the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Of course, I guess manifestos, people want that to be read.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they think they're so fucking grandiose.
Maybe burn your diaries. Or don't write it down in the first place.
But this is the narcissism in him. I know. This is the narcissism.
He could turn it into a book someday.
Well, all those diaries are his brilliance. Right. Okay.
Right.
It's just my brilliance. I didn't kill anyone. I'm just talking about my brilliance on here.
Right. Right.
So Einhorn also told supporters that the feds considered him a threat and they were still furious with him for his participation in the anti-war movement and his communications with peaceniks behind the Iron Curtain.
No, actually, we don't like it that you murder people.
Yeah. Right.
It's really like the murder that's the problem. It's not really like, you know.
Yeah.
Anything else.
He also claimed that they wanted him out of the way because of his pioneering work on the internet.
Oh, brother.
And his desire to make it international in scope beyond the control of the federal government. So he was also.
Oh, so he invented the internet now.
Apparently. Okay. Also.
Okay.
Okay. This is just giving you a little snippet and like a little glance into the mind of his psyche. He was on the verge of discovering the government's mind controlling weaponry. So they'd set him up. To make sure he was quiet.
That's Charles Manson.
Yeah.
If this guy had access, I mean, if this guy really wanted to, he could have had a cult.
I kind of think he did have a cult.
I mean, they just weren't all in one place, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, which in a way is kind of scarier because it was almost like he was a cult leader of just this weird, like, I don't know, randomness. Mm-hmm. It's just so bizarre to me. So the judge was definitely swayed by all the character witness statements, and they set bail.
Probably also blackmailed.
Yeah, maybe. But they set bail, and when they set bail, people in the courtroom were clapping. They were so happy.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yay, Einhorn's out on bail. He was smiling ear to ear. There's fucking photos of this. I hate his face. Detective Chitwood knew that Einhorn would skip the country. He said, quote, I told the other homicide detectives, this guy will never come to trial. He'll take off.
Right.
Well, guess what?
Duh.
Detective Chitwood was right. 2 months before his trial was to begin in January 1981, Einhorn fled the country to avoid trial. So between the time that he was put out on bail and the time that his trial was supposed to start, he had this team. They were starting the trial business. He was going through the motions of all that. And then... just didn't show up.
Bye.
Just he was gone. So, color me surprised, April.
I know.
I mean, shocked. Yeah, I'm just shocked. A bench warrant was issued for his arrest and an international manhunt was launched. A few months later, a man visiting the U.S. from Ireland told investigators that he thought there was a guy living in his home they were looking for.
Oh.
Yeah, a guy living in his home in Ireland. So he actually just came over to visit family in the U.S. and he was just nonchalantly telling his family.
Oh, by the way, I think this guy.
No, he was just telling his family, oh, I got this nice young man. He's staying with me in Dublin. He says his name is Ira Einhorn. And his family's like, what the fuck? Like, you know that guy is wanted for murder. And he was like, oh, what? No. Yeah. So he goes to the FBI, tells them, and the FBI shows him a photo and he said, yeah, that's the guy. That's the guy living. And the hubris of Ira. Like, let me just use my real name. Not even make a fake name.
He couldn't let his name go. Which, the unicorn.
Well, he does use fake names later, but right. I guess that time he didn't. Which is so crazy. So the FBI calls Ireland police. But Ireland, there was no extradition treaty during that time. In the 70s, or this was the 80s, in the 80s. Mm-hmm. There was none. So Ireland was basically like, well, yeah, he's here. Nothing we can do. Ireland. I hope this has changed. I meant to actually look it up. I think they do have an extradition treaty now.
They should.
I hope so, because that's insane.
Or else we'd all just go to Ireland.
Yeah. I do want to go to Ireland.
If we get in trouble, we'll just go to Ireland.
But anyway, so he does realize that the police are onto him, and he leaves Ireland and is on the move again. So during this time, Holly's family has to live with the fact that not only they've lost their daughter and their sister, but this shitbag is living it up in Europe somewhere and he can't be found. And then years go by. Years. 7 years after this, in 1988, 7 years after he went on the lam, as he likes to call it, Holly's father, Fred, completed suicide.
Aww.
I know. His daughter, Holly's sister, Buffy Hall, said that he had a long illness and was in a lot of pain. And then 2 years later in 1990, her mother also passed away. And it's really sad because she said, for all intents and purposes, both her parents died the day that Holly died.
Yeah.
They were never the same. She was 17 when Holly was murdered, and she said that she basically became an orphan because she lost her parents when they lost her.
Wow.
Isn't that sad?
That's terrible.
So you kind of wonder about her father's suicide. I mean, it could have partly been that reason also.
Yeah.
Which is very sad. So in the early early 90s, Pennsylvania law changed to allow the state to try a defender in absentia.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. So if you could prove that the defendant purposely fled to avoid trial, you could do this, which obviously he did. That was obvious. In absentia, meaning they do not need to be present at their own trial. In 1993, 12 years after Einhorn fled the country, Philadelphia DA Lynn Abraham decided to bring him to trial in his absence.
Good.
Which was a rare legal procedure.
They're like, actually, we have enough evidence. We don't even need you. Well, because a lot of times in criminal investigations, I mean, trials, the person being prosecuted doesn't even talk.
True.
So it's like, we don't really need you to be here anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
But this is the only in absentia murder trial ever conducted in Philadelphia.
Oh.
Yeah. So look at Ira just making history all over the place.
Sure, he feels so special.
Oh, yeah. So Einhorn was represented by Norris Gelman, his lawyer at the time of his flight, who was obliged by the court to conduct the defense at his own expense, which I think is kind of funny. During a week in court, the leaking liquid, the smell of putrefaction, the scream, and other strong circumstantial evidence was put on trial. So basically, this just goes on like a regular trial. Everything is the same except you're basically trying an empty chair.
Right.
You know? Gelman was able to demonstrate that – now, Gelman is the defense attorney. He was able to demonstrate that the forensic evidence on which the prosecution hung its case was inconclusive. The prosecution was unable to prove that the putrefying liquid contained human protein. So they couldn't say there's human protein in this liquid.
That's weird.
Which – who the fuck cares? Her body's in his fucking closet.
Yeah.
But whatever. Okay. Blah, blah, blah.
Is it like the way they...
The law.
The way that they got the search warrant to get the evidence?
I don't know. Okay. But anyway, there. I don't know. I don't think it was that because he was just basically saying it was possible, at least in theory, that Holly's body was planted in Einhorn's closet and wasn't... He didn't put her there.
Okay.
So like that liquid may not have been from her.
That's a weird fucking theory.
You gotta do what you gotta do as the defense attorney, I guess. So... The jury nevertheless took only 2 hours to convict him of first-degree murder like, and sentence him to life imprisonment.
No.
So, hello, empty chair. You have now been convicted.
Yeah.
The idea of having an absentia trial is that if you are found, you do not have a new trial.
Nope.
And you go directly to jail under that sentencing. So you do not pass go. You do not get your fucking $200. your sentence is there.
Yeah.
You're done. So we found you. Boom. You're done.
Yeah.
So, now, would it be of any surprise to you that Ira has had a wealthy friend assisting him over the years?
No, it wouldn't surprise me at all.
No, he had to.
It's for the cause, man.
I think it would be difficult to skip. I mean, I think it would be almost, I don't want to say impossible. I think it would be very difficult to skip the country now. Maybe easier back then.
Well, especially if you didn't have a bunch of money. If you had a bunch of money, it wouldn't be that hard.
Right, but I mean, how did he not use a passport? None of that was flagged. Like, it's a
private plane.
Yeah.
If you fly private, if it's your own private plane, you don't have to show anything.
Well, there you go.
You don't have to go through, you might have to go through customs. I don't think you do.
I don't know, but that is exactly what happened. So money talks.
Yeah.
And Ira walks. That's what happened. Yeah. So he needed connections and he had them. Investigators discover that a woman by the name of Barbara Bronfman, a wealthy friend of Einhorn's, had been assisting him with money. She was divorced from Edgar Bronfman, who owned Seagram 7. She lived in Canada, and she obviously was very wealthy.
Yeah.
She did come and speak with investigators and admitted that she had been funneling funds to Ira. She said that she did believe him in the past, but she has since changed her tune. She actually said that she read a book released about Einhorn and has seen the light, so to speak, and realizes who he really is, which I'm betting is the book that I talked about because there's been no other book.
Yeah.
So, and it came out in 1990. So she went to speak with them and was like, I realize he's a murderer. I don't want to help him anymore. And she told them that Ira was with a woman by the name of Anika Floden. Now, Anika Floden also has money. Big surprise. Okay. I don't think he hangs out with people who don't have money.
No.
So she was an heiress to a retail empire in Sweden. Oh. With this knowledge, they start the search for Anika Floden. Because before they're doing the search for Ira, now it's like, well, now we have someone else we can search for.
If we search know for her name.
Yeah, if we search for her, we'll find him. The FBI called the Swedish police directly and asked them to look in her file for anything that might be helpful. And in her file, and I'm not really sure what that means, in her file. I mean, maybe like when you leave the country and then you request certain things, there is like a file that they keep on you. I don't know. But anyway, Sweden had a file, apparently.
Sweden doesn't have that many people, and maybe they just keep files on everybody.
I
don't
know. I kind of feel like we probably have files, too. Like, well, you know, America.
You can run like a rap sheet.
Yeah, but I think this is different because in her file, there was a letter asking for a copy of her Swedish driver's license to be sent to an address in Champagne-Mouton, France.
Oh.
So she could get a French driver's license. That's what I'm saying.
So maybe it's like a government file.
Yeah, like when you're in a different country and then you request certain things.
Not that specifically, but like if you run a rap sheet on someone, it'll tell you like what state licenses they've applied for.
Yeah, so kind of maybe like that.
Or like if they've applied for, I don't know, to like get your certification to be a police officer or be on state assistance or anything like that, it'll show.
Well, and you probably have to request from the government specifically, like, I want a copy of this so that I can get this.
Yeah.
And so that they put that in your file.
Okay.
And so she had an actual address listed on that letter. And this is legit the first solid lead the FBI had had in years.
Yeah.
On May 15th, 1997, which was Einhorn's 57th birthday.
Fucker.
The address was secured.
Gotcha.
Gotcha, motherfucker. So Champagne-Mouton is a small and sleepy village in the wine country of southwestern France. And it's probably so pretty.
He doesn't deserve it.
I fucking hate that he lived there.
Yeah.
The FBI contacted the French National Police and they conducted some surveillance and concluded pretty quickly it was indeed Ira Einhorn living with Anika Floden.
Gotcha.
Didn't have the dark hair anymore, had gray hair, but he still looked like a piece of shit. Oh, look, there's a piece of shit. That must be Ira.
He did look like a piece of shit.
So it had been 20 years since Holly's murder and 16 years since Ira had been on the run. In June, French police went to Anika Floden's home. They went upstairs, and Ira's just laying in bed naked. Again!
Of course.
Every time the cops show up, that fucker's naked.
He's probably naked always.
Ugh. And they take him into custody.
And at this point, he's like old and naked.
Old and naked. He was.
I saw his pictures.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd be like, sir.
Sir.
Put some clothes on.
He's not. He shouldn't be called sir.
Ugh.
So Claudette Racaud, I know I'm going to say that wrong, sir, but he runs the village tobacconists, which I think is so cute. I want a village tobacconist. Yeah. So he probably like, you know, does pipes and shit.
Oh, that's cool. He rolls all the French cigarettes.
Yes, I'm going to give this to you. I love it. I would love to visit this place. But he was interviewed and he said, quote, his name was supposed to be Milan. Eugene Milan. We understood he was a writer from England. We didn't see him much. He or his wife would come in twice a week for their special order of the Herald Tribune. He was nice, always smiling, but he couldn't speak much French. His wife was friendly, though. So he was just a dude.
He probably just had that Philadelphia accent.
He was Eugene Milan, a writer from England. It sounds so romantic. I hate him. Okay. So the U.S. had a treaty of extradition with France.
Good.
Seemed cut and dried. And the FBI was ready for him to return to America and serve his time. But nothing is cut and dried for fucking Einhorn, okay? Einhorn was taken before three magistrates in France. And the magistrates thought extradition was a violation of his human rights because the state of Pennsylvania was not going to retry him.
I'm sorry. Human rights?
Yep. So basically, the fact that the state had tried and convicted Einhorn in absentia literally became the reason that France would not allow the extradition.
Fucking France.
France has a law which firmly states that defendants tried in absentia must receive a new trial when they appear so they can speak in their own defense.
Well, that's French's rules. He did not commit crimes in France. He committed crimes in Philadelphia where they allow trial in absentia.
And the state of Pennsylvania.
Nothing to do with France.
And the state of Pennsylvania had no such law. They were like, we don't have that law.
Yeah.
They're like, well, guess what? We do, and we're in charge. We are the French, and we are in charge of this. And so, I mean, you know, they have to set their example. Like, this is our law. I mean, I know.
It makes me mad.
It makes me mad because
just because he ran there doesn't mean that you get to make any rules. He's not your person.
I know. And it also is really frustrating because it's fucking Ira. And I don't know why, like, he just always seems to get out of everything, you know?
And if we're talking about human rights violations, what about his girlfriend? Speaking of human rights mm-hmm. violations.
Yeah.
Nobody ever thinks of the victims. That makes me crazy.
Yep. So in December 1997, a French court denied the request to extradite Einhorn. So basically, he's now being protected by French law. Isn't that crazy? So Holly's family were like, oh, hell no. They were pissed. Wouldn't you? You finally find him and then you can't bring him home.
Yep.
So they spent the next several months calling congressmen and working to get the laws around absentia trials changed. Because they're like, fine, they make a law.
Yeah.
Appease France, make the fucking law.
Yeah.
In 1997, the Pennsylvania legislature passed a law which grants courts the power to offer new trials in special cases such as Einhorn's. So her family and
they're like, retry. It doesn't matter if you retry him. We're going to come to the same conclusion.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert. So
he's not going to get out of it.
Holly's family also, which I think was very smart of them, they made the decision to go to France to really put a face to Holly's story. Because I think it's like you said, what about Holly's human rights? Well, it's so easy to forget about the victim. Right. And I think that's really what happened
here. It's just paperwork after a while.
Yeah. And he is so grandiose and so, like, his whole personality is so huge, it overshadowed all of that,
right?
And so they went there, they held her picture, they held media conferences, and they really wanted France and everyone to know that Holly was a person who was deeply loved, and this was about her, not about him,
right?
And it's really cool to watch. You can see footage, like, on YouTube of it, and, you know, It was a really good idea. They did that. So at last, authorities in France agreed to extradition for Einhorn with the proviso, which is also following French law, that he not be given the death penalty because they don't have the death penalty.
Well, he wasn't given a death penalty anyway.
Even though they used to chop people's heads off in the...
Yeah, we just guillotine people. But
they realized that that was not cool, so they don't do that anymore.
We've learned from our errors.
I know. What kind of entertainment are we supposed to have these days?
People? Well, look, our country's still young. We haven't had enough time to, like, behead all of our people yet.
That's true.
We're not ready to let it go.
So he appealed the extradition decision for another 3 years. Just, I can't imagine what this family was going through. It's just, oh, and now we have him. Oh, and no. Now we got to wait 3 more years.
Put him on a plane.
I cannot. But finally, in July 2001, he was finally ordered to be extradited. And when the French police showed up to take him into custody, oh my God, this is just so dramatic. He took a fucking razor blade and tried to cut his own throat front of reporters.
You should have done it earlier.
Like, what are you doing? And you can actually see this on YouTube. Go watch it or don't. Nobody cares. But he's just so dumb.
What an idiot.
And his wife is standing by his side. Like, she truly believes in him still. Like, doesn't believe that he committed this crime.
Weird. But, or she does and she just doesn't care. I can't imagine that he was never violent after that.
I can't either.
With his new wife. She was probably in the same situation that Holly was in.
Who knows? Anyway, they bandaged up his stupid neck and he was taken.
Tie it a little tighter.
Yeah, I know. It's actually funny. You can see footage of him, like, getting in the van. And he's got this big white thing around his neck. And you're like, whatever, dude. And it was so superficial.
Yeah.
Maybe he barely even did it. He's like, oh, let me. Whatever. So they bandaged up his neck. Like I said, he was taken and flown back to the U.S. to become prisoner number ES6859. So that is now your new name.
Yeah. Just like your stupid book.
Yeah. So once he returned to Pennsylvania, a new trial began. A former girlfriend he dated at Penn University testified at his trial about their relationship.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Judith Sabat was a sophomore at the University of Pennsylvania when she met Einhorn in 1965. They had an intense four-month relationship. And during that time, he became increasingly domineering and manipulative. And that's quote unquote, basically what she said at the trial.
Yeah.
Judith was a beautiful, smart redhead. And Ira was drawn to redheads. In fact, Annika Floden was also a redhead. He once said to a friend, quote, the attribute has the same effect on me as marijuana. Delicious ecstasy.
Okay.
Oh, fucking die. So Einhorn had urged. Creep. I know. Einhorn had urged Judith to break ties. So this is all before he met Holly.
Right.
Einhorn had urged Judith to break ties with her bourgeois family in Connecticut. He believed her parents and siblings were, quote, sentimental shackles holding her back from true liberation.
Okay.
No, you're doing the typical shit of getting people away from their families.
Yeah, isolate to then abuse.
Exactly. She knew this relationship was going nowhere good, and she tried to pull away. So, of course, he grew more obsessed with her. He wrote in his journal in November 1965, again, the journals, quote, the violence that flowed through my being tonight still awaits further dark confirmation of its existence, which could result in the murder of that which I seem to love so deeply. There is a good chance that I will attempt to kill Judy tonight. The rational awareness of this fact brings stark terror into my heart, but it must be faced if I wish to go on.
So how did she escape death?
Actually, he said, I will attempt to kill Judy tomorrow, not tonight. Huh?
Oh. How did she escape death?
Well, let's see. He also wrote, quote, violence creeps over my body as I reach toward the destruction of Judy, a hopeless victim in this infernal entanglement which seems to be draining the life out of both of us. We hang in perilous balance, threatened to destroy or be destroyed in an instant of reckless action. We must come together or die. What does that even mean?
Nothing.
Like, you're such an idiot.
The things I don't understand about his journal entries are like, dude, you're the only one reading them. Why are you talking like this to yourself?
Oh, no, he's thinking that other people are going to read these. I guess. Oh, yeah, he totally is. So in March 1966, during spring break, Einhorn stopped by Judith's father's apartment where she was staying during her break. He wanted to talk about reviving their relationship. She offered to make coffee, but there was no milk, so she went to the corner store, which is so cute. I just love that she went to the corner store. Like, I'd be like, we don't have milk. Drink it black, fucker. You know? But no, she's like, let me go get you some milk. Like, that just shows that she's a nice person.
Yeah.
While she was gone, he hid behind the door. So when she returned to what she thought was an empty room, he actually jumped her from behind and smashed her over the head with a Coke bottle.
Oh, so she didn't escape.
She did not. She fell and cut her arm on the jagged glass, and then he had his hands around her neck choking her.
Wow.
She begged him to stop, said she couldn't breathe, and she thought she was dying, and then he just left. She had no idea why he left, no idea why he let her live. But she literally thought she was going to die that day.
Yeah.
So Judith decided not to tell the police about the assault back in 1966. Because people didn't really trust the police. And honestly, women were used to being questioned and were often accused of provoking their attackers. Right. And it still happens today.
Yeah.
So the campus security officers who drove her to the hospital and the medical resident who stitched up her head wound never even questioned her about her injuries.
Hmm.
Typical.
Yeah.
11 years later, he would murder Holly Maddox. After attacking Judith and leaving her alone in the apartment, he walked home and penned a poem in his journal. Would you like to hear it?
Not really, but you can read it anyway.
Suddenly it happens. A bottle in hand I strike. Away at the head. In such violence, there may be freedom. Okay. Yep. So Einhorn's journals, which were more than 10,000 pages, were crucial to the prosecution's case.
10,000 pages?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's obsessed with himself.
He absolutely is. Assistant District Attorney Joel Rosen read the bottle poem entitled, quote, "An Act of Violence" to the jury during the opening arguments in 2002. In 1962, he's
like, actually, you wrote the whole trial for us. Thanks.
Yeah, actually, thanks. I'm just going to read the shit. And yeah.
That's all we needed.
That's all you need. He, in 1962, he wrote, quote, "To kill what you love when you can't have it seems so natural that strangling Rita last night seemed so right." And he was referring to a previous girlfriend that he assaulted at Bennington College, also after she'd broken up with him. So there is a pattern here.
Yeah. I think it has to do with his ego.
Yeah. He's a sociopath.
Yeah.
So Judith Sabbath's adult daughter, Diana Whitney, actually wrote this beautiful article in 2018 about her mother and how she found out about her mother's trauma and what her mother endured. She didn't know her entire life about this. It's called "The Killer Who Spared My Mother." And her mom did not tell her until Ira was returned and this trial began in 2002. Wow. Yeah. So she didn't know her. She was an adult with children at this point. She was 29 before she even heard the story. And I really highly suggest reading this article. In her article, she says, quote, "I was thinking about generational patterns of female silence, about my trouble saying no to men, about my date rape at Dartmouth, that infamous enclave of Ivy League privilege where lacrosse players bared their perfect white grins in Animal House basements, about the male sexual entitlement that's alive and well, disputed but not gone in the era of Me Too. In a phone interview with therapist Mark Wolin, he called this repetition an ancestral alarm clock and urged me to break the cycle before my daughters grew up." And it's such a great commentary on that, on why her mother was silent, on why all these women have been silent.
Right.
And just and also generationally, you know, how this happens. Mm-hmm. And she even said at one point, like, she was so mad at her mother. Why didn't you tell me? Like, I feel like I needed this information. Like, why? And then I felt like I did things or I got myself in situations, conceded to things I didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. Because that's what women do. You know, a lot of women do in this world. So anyway, it's a really good article. I highly suggest it. On October 17th, 2002, 25 years after he was accused of the crime, Ira Einhorn, who was 62, received an automatic sentence of life in prison without parole on the first degree murder charge. So you are correct, April. He was tried and subsequently convicted again.
Yeah, you can get out of that one, bud.
So he still maintained his innocence and his accusations of secret government agencies having committed the murder of Holly Maddox.
Okay, but at this point, you're in the 2000s.
Yeah, the fucking unicorn.
Nobody's paying attention to that anymore?
Nobody cares.
It may have worked in the 70s, but it's not going
to
work now.
Yeah, and he really thought himself to be so deep and poetic, but his poems basically suck shit. I mean, he's so grandiose and you're over the top and cliche. I mean, it's just, it's like, this is what, you know, junior high kids write when they're just starting to write poetry. Like, it's not good, dude. In 2010, reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Ronnie Polonesky, interviewed Einhorn at the Hootsdale State Correctional Institution in Clearfield County. He was 70 at the time. He sent the Inquirer a letter asking to talk to them because he wanted to talk about the flawed justice system.
Of course he does.
Yeah. During the interview, he mostly complained about how all the letters he'd written to politicians and important public figures have gone unanswered.
Well, here's a little tidbit. They never get to anyone. There's a secretary or a person who works for the person who you're writing to.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And they put a stamp on it and they say, I don't know, help this guy with his problems. They pass it along to somebody else. Yeah,
and they pass it to someone else.
And then really, it's just the guy who's standing outside of your cell that gets to answer it and go, oh, yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah. And he said,
it's all just comes down this chain.
I know. He said, I am a pariah. Once you're in prison, it's as if you no longer exist, which must have burned him so hard because being irrelevant is probably one of his biggest nightmares.
It's worse than dying.
It's literally worse than dying. Yeah. So he also told Polonesky, I had a quote, I had a lot of lovers when I was younger, anywhere from 1500 to 1800. I had a lot of erotic energy, though not Wilt Chamberlain's erotic energy. But from the moment I met my wife, I was a monogamous. He's talking about Anika.
Wilt Chamberlain, the basketball player?
No.
Who's Wilt Chamberlain?
Oh my God. Look it up. That is so funny. I can't even. You look it up and I'll keep talking.
Okay.
While in prison, he would rise at 5 a.m., work on a series of erotic short stories. Because, you know, you want to all about the erotic
short
stories.
We want to know the erotic short stories.
Fucking Ira.
Yeah.
And his stinky pits. Ew. He was writing and composed a journal entry every morning, as he did every day since the early 60s. So he every day. He said that his journals comprised over 30,000 pages. He also said he would like his journals archived in a university after his death for study.
All I can find on Wilt Chamberlain is the basketball player.
Wilt. W-I-L-T. Yeah,
that's what I did. Chamberlain. He was a 7'1" basketball player for...
Did he have erotic energy?
I mean, he's in a power pose in these pictures. I don't know if that's erotic energy.
I thought he was like an actor guy, but you know what? Maybe I'm thinking of something else.
You want to hear his AKAs? Wilt the Stilt, the Big Dipper, Dippy, Dip, the Load.
Well, why did he say that?
Big Musty, and the Record Book.
Okay, well, I'm going to do
more research on this. So maybe it was him.
Okay.
He played in Philadelphia.
That must have been it then.
So.
All right, Wilt.
Are you freaking laughing at me?
I thought it was, I was thinking of that actor from the 50s, somebody Chamberlain. Oh. Who was that? He was in the Thornbirds. I don't know. Well, you were right. I have no fucking, this is why I try to look things up, but I always forget. I'm like, oh shoot, I was going to look that up. I forgot. Okay.
Richard Chamberlain?
Yeah, it was Richard I'm thinking of.
Let's see if he has erotic
energy. I don't think he has. He wasn't talking about Richard.
No, he has a... He's a priest in this movie.
Yeah, Thornbirds, yeah. But he...
I don't see any erotic energy
He went here. Against his vows and had sex with Raquel Welch, which who wouldn't? She was fucking gorgeous. Okay.
Yeah, she was.
Okay. So he also apparently wrote a book called Prelude to Intimacy, published in 2005, which is just a long ramble of how difficult it was for him being on the lam in Europe and all the stupid shit he did while he was there.
Okay.
Which was basically read, write, and have sex. That's like all he did. I hate him so much. So I refuse to buy it, obviously, because I don't know where this money's going.
Yeah.
But I did read a sample and it's nauseating. He was I did read a few, like there was like 50 pages you have access to, and then like maybe 200 pages you don't have access to.
I think you'd get the picture in the 50 pages.
I got the picture. So he was talking about a woman he dated while in Dublin. This is after he left right. in 81, okay. And he was dating this woman, which I don't see how he dated so many people while being on the lam, but he did, by the name of Jean-Marie. And he wrote, quote, "I made the same mistake with Jean-Marie that I made with the woman I'm accused of murdering, Holly Maddox. In both instances, I allowed my first impression of an attractive woman to rule my behavior. Both women were essentially overwhelmed by my energy, and after an initial long sexual encounter, both began to live with me. Both women were essentially servicing me sexually, and neither of them had orgasms during sex with me. That was one of the main reasons that I had so many lovers while living with both Holly and Jean-Marie." Okay, first of all, the woman I'm accused of murdering, like this was apparently someone that you lived with for 5 years and loved. Like, that's all she's been, like...
That's just what she boils down to.
That's
now.
What she boils... The woman I'm accused of murdering. Also... Maybe you just suck and can't give women orgasms. I don't know. But anyway, that's the reason that he cheated on them. Because he couldn't get them to climax.
That's so psycho.
I just cannot. Okay. Anyway, he also had a blog. Like, I just really wanted
to. A blog?
He had a blog while he was in prison. And a few people kept it up for him and posted for him. And it's basically like this Free Ira thing. Like, Free Ira, he's innocent, blah, blah, blah. And the person who does, I'm not even going to say his name, whatever. He's actually a PhD, which is so weird to me. But he did a foreword in this dumb book that he wrote about the intimacy book. And he truly believes that he didn't get a fair trial.
Well, he was tried twice.
Yeah. He also, like, there's this whole blog post about the smell, you know, the putrefaction smell. He wrote about the smell that helped to get him convicted, saying there was never any smell. He had people over and no one smelled anything. This just reinforces that I was set up. Like, he wrote this whole long thing about it.
Maybe they just thought that it was you.
Oh my God. Yeah, because you stink. Maybe that's why you
smell like a dead body.
Also, when you Google Ira Ironhorn, at the top, you know, like, it'll say, like, actor or, you know, discoverer of DNA or whatever the fuck they are. Okay. When you Google Ira Einhorn, it says peace activist. Then you scroll down a little bit and it says criminal charge, murder. Okay, get it to fucking gather, Google. Yeah. I don't like the fact that it says peace activist. No. It really bothers me. I would prefer to see murderer under there. So can we make this happen? Everyone write Google. Tell them. What I mean, and
call
I
call the Googles.
It is kind of tongue in cheek because it's like peace activist, murder. And it's like, okay, you are not. No, I no. just I cannot. Okay. Anyway, moving on the 3rd of April 2020, which was not very long ago, Einhorn, who was aged 79, died in the Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Laurel Highlands. His death was reported to be of natural causes and not related to COVID. Because, you know, they always have to say that now.
Yeah.
And that is the story of the murder of Holly Maddox and the murderous unicorn.
Dang.
And I'm really glad I got to end with him dead. I mean, I'm sorry to say it, but.
We're glad that you died before the podcast started.
I mean, he lived a very long life.
Too long.
Yeah.
How do you live with a dead body in your bedroom for almost 2 years?
I don't know. But he didn't because someone put it there. They planted it. That body was somewhere else and then they brought it in. They had keys to the lock.
Oh, that makes sense.
They had keys to the lock.
I hate him.
I hate him too. But I do.
I only wish that he was alive so he could hear this podcast, so he could hear us just laughing at him and his ridiculousness.
Of course, then we're making him relevant, not irrelevant. But
power by being relevant. So
that's true. Yeah.
Boo for you.
But anyway, go to Instagram, look at the photos of our beautiful drink that he didn't deserve. Our drink was
so fun.
The drink is really fun.
He didn't deserve it.
I'll post some pictures of Ira's fucking face.
His old wrinkly face.
Yeah. And his young hairy face. Yeah.
He really had an out of control beard.
He had an out of control everything.
Hair.
Everything was out of control. Odor.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of wish that I was born with just a fraction of some of the narcissism that these people have, because I feel like you just feel like you can do anything.
Yeah.
Nothing will stop me. And right. I mean, in a way, that's not a bad thing to have, but then it just goes too far.
Yeah.
It's like it's magnetized or magnified.
Yeah, I think getting away with murder is literally like the epitome of.
Yeah.
Power. Yeah. Like you could put your mind to anything and do it.
Yeah.
Get away with murder.
So anyway, I thought I wasn't really going to have much to say about this. And then all of a sudden, I had a gabillion things to say about
it. We're in an hour and 42 minutes.
Sorry, guys.
Well, I hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, and tell them where they can find us.
Oh, you can find us if you have any stories that you want to hear or cocktails you would like us to feature or spirits you'd like us to try out. You can contact us at killerspiritspod@gmail.com. We're on Twitter at killerspirits, on Instagram at killerspiritspod. And on Patreon at patreon.com/killerspirits, where you can find all of our videos for our cocktails.
Yeah, and you can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, we're even on...
Anywhere.
Yeah.
Audible.
Audible now. And leave us a review on iTunes, we would love it.
Yeah.
We love you guys.
Thanks, bye.
Bye.
Hey, this is Alex and Jackson from the Imbibe the Vibe podcast. It's a show where we take music, we take cocktails, and we put them together. And we also teach you how to make those fancy cocktails from scratch so you can do it at home.
The same way you would pair a fine meal with an exquisite wine.
We pair fine music with exquisite fancy cocktails. Listen to us on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your pod. And remember, have fun out there.
Have fun, why don't you?